This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Melinda's discussion of the grid and the importance of the straight line made me think of that. I might mangle the line, but there's that wonderful line by Roald Dahl where the BFG talks about where he's gone to Buckingham Palace and it's about a ruler of straight lines. Anyway. Both Nick and Melinda have taken us forward from the 19th century, and Jonathan Jones is going to take us further. A crucial part of today, when I was talking about the event with Andrew, was to have an artist who was both engaged with Andrew's book and the work within it be part of our symposium. And so it's wonderful to have Jonathan here to do that. Jonathan Jones.
Yoruru marang, mujigilang, hiwindi Jonathan Jones, baladu redribu gamilaroi gibir, nati banigu gulbara nanawu, mayan galang narangu, narambang nati nina duraringa. Hello, everyone. My name's Jonathan Jones. I'm a Wiradjuri Kamilaroi man from the southeast, and I'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, whose country we meet on today, and thank Aunty Susan this morning for her welcome. I'd also like to acknowledge Andrew and thank the organisers, obviously, for creating such an important space for us today to talk about some really important issues as my computer decides to windmill. Oh, there we go. I'd also like to make a special acknowledgement today of Aunty Joy, whose leadership, wisdom and humour has been an ongoing source of inspiration for me. Her support has led to many of the ideas I'll discuss with you today, and I'd like to take this opportunity to publicly thank her. I'd also like to dedicate this talk to my cousin Emily, who's here today, and all younger generations of Koori's. This talk is really for you. So firstly, I think it's important to state up front that the publication, Aboriginal Artists of the 19th Century, and I say publication because I was unfortunately not able to see the exhibition, had an enormous impact on my life and has definitely helped define much of my practice both as an artist and a curator. I first came into contact with the publication as an undergrad student, and the book quickly became my holy grail, the only book I would work with at university, and the name Andrew Sayers was definitely said with much reverence. I felt it was the first time that Koori art history, the history of my people, had actually been acknowledged, and the important work of my ancestors had been recognised. It was the first time I could see myself within a book and see where I'd come from. And although I'm never sure of who you actually wrote the book for, I always thought you wrote it for me, which was great. For me, the critical moment that actually occurred for me, or the light bulb moment, if you like, that occurred for me was the kind of the rupture in between Andrew's text that weaved in and out of intelligent readings of important historical accounts that described work of Koori master artists, including Tommy McRae, William Brack and Mickey Avalladulla, who we've talked about today, and the text written by Carol Cooper on the traditional carving practices of the southeast. The artistic connection drawn between these two art movements, Koori art masters and traditional carving, starts to inform us about Koori art men's practice from this region. It's from this foothold, really, that I started to do my research and try, in an attempt for myself, to define Koori artist, a wider Koori artistic movement. My research has come to consider one particular strand of Koori artistic practice, that is the region's unique and continuing use of the line as an artistic device, primarily by male artists. This research has been structured within four distinct periods or generations from pre-contact to today, and has helped to and has established a clear cultural tradition that has endured under massive change. The research uniquely places Koori art within a historical context and constructed quite importantly within a Koori framework, which I'll discuss. They've sort of jumped around. So my research, on my research journey, one of the real key issues for me was recognising the striking similarities between the work of Tommy McRae and the work of contemporary artist Roy Kennedy. And in fact, I remember talking to Andrew about this the very first time we met a number of years back. So Uncle Roy is a Wiradjuri artist who has strong connections to Warrangasta Mission through his mum, but also Police Paddock Mission, which are both on the Murrumbidgee River near Darlington Point. After a lifetime of itinerant work, mainly knocking around railway yards, Uncle Roy enrolled at Eora College, an Aboriginal TAFE college in Redfern, Sydney. It was here in his 60s that Uncle Roy developed a passion for dry point etching, slowly carving his memories onto metal plates. Uncle Roy not only calls up connections to McRae visually, but also, I guess, the action of Southeast carving practices. The ideas very much manifested between those two texts in Aboriginal artists of the 19th century. And interestingly enough, Roy actually remembers watching both his grandfather and his stepfather carving weapons for sale, but also for hunting. Uncle Roy's work are repeated citations of mission memories. His work captures mission life, where both church, police and the police station loom large on the landscape, while the regimented mission houses and rambling fences underpin almost every image. What was surprising to me was that Uncle Roy had never heard or seen of the work of Tommy McRae. Never. Yet the work was so connected in so many ways. Both work used small multiple strokes to create their images. Tommy with pen and ink, Uncle Roy with etching tools that capture a phenomenal level of detail and movement. Both, I believe, express the mind and hand of a carver. The push and pull of positive and negative space to build up a really successful image. Tommy captures people singing out and calling out, weapons in motion, canoes afloat, while Uncle Roy's eye for detail reveals the diamond windows of the local church, the mulberries on the tree, and the powerful currents of the Murrumbidgee. Both are dedicated to recalling the past and their lived memories that chronicle ceremonies and mission life of a time gone by, and in doing so create time capsules for younger generations like myself to read and learn our culture. I should also mention that, strangely, I was the first person to show Uncle Roy Aboriginal artist in the 19th century, and needless to say, he fell in love with it, connecting deeply with McRae. And like Aunty Joy's experience, it goes without saying that I never got that book back, which I think is probably the best review you can ever get for a book, and which was a repeated occurrence after showing a whole number of community members. I think I've probably bought a lot of books in my time, replacing my own. Between McRae and Uncle Roy, there was a link, forming a bigger link, if you like, from a living artist today, living in Redfern, all the way back to traditional carving practices. But what exactly was that link? So in order to start to determine that, I started to look at men's work across the region, from across the ages and across mediums. And I started to see the continuing use of the line to create both figurative and patterned elements. Everyone from La Perouse to Broken Hill, from Moree to Melbourne, from clubs to photography, to prints to possum skin cloaks, could be understood as working with line, including the work of Kevin Gilbert, Mickey of Ulladulla, Robert Campbell Jr., Carved Trees, Lynn Onus, the Victorian Bark Etchings, Badger Bates, Jim Stanley, Southeast Clubs, Barak, Rock Engravings, just to name a few. And it's fantastic to see a few more highlighted to today. They all employ and emphasise the use of the line. I'm also really proud to say that artists from my generation, my contemporaries, most of whom are consciously counteracting colonialism by looking back into the past to the work of their ancestors to make their own work, are often continuing the use of the line. Artists like Brooke Andrews, Stephen Payton, Jason Wing, Rico Rennie, and James Tyler are all making powerful images and referencing their ancestors. And in this way, the line becomes a witness in the line, as witnessed in art-making practices, takes on a new metaphorical meaning. It comes to represent a continuation of culture, the unbroken line of Koori knowledge and space, which is reflected in a statement by Rodney Carter, a Yorta Yorta man who stated that shields, or the symbols upon those shields, represent identity. You can liken them to what we see as title deeds for our houses. lines, the colours, the carvings, they all tell people who you are, and more importantly, they tell people where you come from. This concept was also echoed in an important historical account given by Smyth when he described what's assumed to be a Tuggeranong club and its design, stating that the Illil represents a lagoon, probably a branch of the Broken River, and the space enclosed by those lines, the country, which the tribe of the owners of the weapon occupies. Another important cultural reading of this of the line in relation to country was given by W.S. Parks, who was told this story by a Wiradjuri elder living at Brungal in 1848, who described Wiradjuri country as a line rather than an enclosed area. Parks, quoting from memory, detailed the line as passing through Brungal, Jugion, Harden, Cowra, Dubbo, Condoblin, Hulston, Wagga Wagga, Tarkata, all the way back to Brungal. In an effort to make sense of this enormous body of work from the southeast, lists and lists of artists, I decided to try and look back at a traditional archiving system, a traditional Koori kinship system, if you like, as a way to sort of, I guess, recall or try and understand how my ancestors would have seen the world, as if they were here with me today, and how perhaps they would have made sense of their descendants. Within the majority of Koori or Southeast, kinship systems or philosophies, as some of you would know, are divided into two moieties, which is the crow and the eagle. In Wiradjuri, Wagan, the crow, or Wan for Ani Joy, Malian, or the wedge-tailed eagle, Malian is in Wiradjuri, or Bunjil for Ani Joy. In most parts of the southeast, these two moieties, which control everything, are then further divided into four subsets. So this traditional structure, if you like, has become a framework for my research. Each subset is represented by the four distinct periods or generations, if you like, within the southeast history, taking into account important social and cultural factors. And each period is then represented by a pair of artists or art forms to symbolise the crow and the eagle. I've curated, if you like, these pairs as they exemplify artistic practices from the region and the period and the social conditions, as well as being highly respected artists from their community. This traditional structure sees our artistic movement framed within a cyclical line of descent. It's an idea, I guess, we've been talking about, following in the footsteps of your ancestors. That is one that is self-perpetuating, self-reflective, and like many artistic movements. So the four pairs are as follows, and these have kind of been trimmed down, I guess, to fit the structure of this talk. But the first section is classic, pre-contact material. This period is represented by praying shields and broad shields have become the two pairs, if you like. Although some of these shields are made after contact, they are traditional in form and, for want of a better word, also with content. The shields and their designs for me represent the foundation of men's work in the southeast. Their selection in the project is based on the fact that they represent one of the most unique cultural productions from the region. And they are comparatively numerous, not many, but comparatively numerous, making a large database to study. They're also quite diverse across the region and are objects of artistic beauty. Researching these shields has involved identifying distinct regional and national designs, patterns and creative styles. This has involved analysing major public collections, including the NMA here. And for this part of the research, I've been lucky enough to work with Carol Cooper, whose sharp mind and research abilities have been the driving force really behind many of the breakthroughs in this area. Together, we're working towards mapping the entire region and looking at specific designs and line work that comes from particular regions and hopefully identify particular artists. One key example that I can show you quickly is this shield here, which is actually held in the British Museum's collection. And the identification of this shield was actually made possible through archival research and visual analysis of the 1866 photographs taken at Corranderk by Carl Walters. where a man known as Redmond, being noted from the Goulburn tribe, which refers to Goulburn River in central Victoria, from analysing his shield and cross-referencing that against that image, it's a very unique design that we've been able to match that shield that's been unknown for a long time, sitting in the British Museum's archive, to Tuggerong people along the Goulburn River. The next group of artists is really Koori Masters, which I guess we don't really need much explanation of these two pairings. But the works that the two artists I've chosen to look at is obviously Tommy McRae and William Barak. As we know, both of these maverick artists were working on the frontier and really witnessed the firsthand the colonisation of their country. Both grappled with a changing world. However, they continued the use of the line. In fact, their artworks are line composite images, with Barak inserting fantastic blocks of colour to create these beautiful figurative forms. Interestingly, both were known to create shields and were proponents, really, of translating traditional practices into new mediums. The next section is self-taught artists or senior Koori artists. This includes the work of Uncle Roy and the late H.J. Wedge. Both are Wiradjuri and both grew up in the harsh conditions on New South Wales missions under strict government segregation policies, which, like the actions of the frontier, were designed to destroy Aboriginal culture. Both Kennedy and Wedge started their art-making practice through the Aboriginal TAFE at Redfern, Eora. And these artists represent a time in Australia's history, the 1990s, when Koori or urban art was being recognised for the first time. Yet sadly, the raised profile of urban art was often dismissed as just political or void of cultural traditions. Like McRae and Barak, their work encompassed ever-changing mediums and subjects, and both continued traditional practices established by their ancestors, really that notion of employing carved methodologies to create their work. As discussed before, Kennedy as an etcher, literally carved into metal plates, while Wedge developed his own personal technique. Not only did his work rely heavily on lineal compositions, but his work would be created first by painting the background of his canvas, and then by using a blunt pencil, he would actually then mark out the outline of his paintings. By using heavy, heavy pressure on the canvas, he in fact scored the canvas and carved into it, which then provided the outline for his paintings. Sadly, as many of you would know, H.J. Wedge passed away recently, a number of years ago now. Doesn't feel like that long ago. And as a key elder who I worked with over the years, his voice will be sadly missed. However, I was lucky enough to have discussed the project with him over a number of years, and he'd been engaged in the research concept. And he would often send me they were sort of a mix of pencil and charcoal drawings in response to flicking through Aboriginal artists in the 19th century. The last section is, I guess, professional or trained contemporary Koori artists. This will focus on two younger artists, Rico Rennie, who is a Gamilaroi man, and Stephen Payton, who is Gunai from down in Gippsland. Both have taken tertiary education and work within new mediums and contexts while continuing figurative line traditions. As contemporary artists, their work is often not seen within this trajectory, yet both are aware of the importance of upholding these practices and have actively been exploring what it means. Rico works within the cultural knowledge directed by his father as an installation and stencil artist. He literally cuts out plastic sheets and uses them as masks to spray over to create his artworks, while Stephen, under the cultural direction of his grandfather, Albert Mullett, explores Gunai traditions and making works as both paper and installations, as you can see here. So these four pair of artists celebrate and highlight the predominant and inherent use of line, informed by thousands of generations of carvers. This line is a visual element that clearly travels through generations of artists, crossing changing environments, social and political conditions. This research testifies to the fact that the Southeast culture is an ongoing and continuous activity, contributing to Aboriginal culture as being the world's oldest living culture. is part of a bigger cultural revolution within the southeast that has seen Indigenous language being taught across the region, canoes being made and possum skin cloaks being taught. Celebrating this cultural continuum strengthens Koori communities and provides the region a framework to support future generations of artists. Mananguru, thank you.
Thanks, Jonathan. One of the great things I look at every day is the Roy Kennedy etching that you gave me, Jonathan, all those years ago when we started talking about these artists. And it's one of the great things, I think, for me about looking at the book 20 years later is the impact it's had on the work of artists. I think all art history, if we can see it, all works of art history, if we can see it then reflected in the work of contemporary artists, is just a great thing. And I thought that the response to the anniversary of William Barrack in the NGV, with which you created, Jonathan, for that, was the most superb piece of contemporary art, with these echoes of William Barrack. It's been the most incredibly rich day for me. I hope it has been for you. I'd like to thank very much Tim, Bonnie Hady and Melinda Hinks, and my two great friends, for thinking of today and making it happen. The National Museum of Australia team, Anne Farris, Heidi, the whole team, Ken, tech crew, all of the speakers today and the chairs. There is one person one entity I should probably thank, and that was the original publishers of the book, Oxford University Press, Louise Sweetland and Peter Rose, editors at the time, who got behind the book, and who really shepherded it into being at a time when it was quite tough to publish that sort of book. And the National Gallery, Betty Churcher, gave me all that time to work on the book, which was a wonderful. It was a display of belief in this project, and I guess we're all believers in this ongoing project. And goodness, isn't it ongoing? There's so many ideas today, so many new strands, so many new directions. I'm incredibly excited to see what's going to emerge as a legacy of the book. Thank you all for joining in this journey today. Now we're going to have a drink. So please join us in the drink in the wonderful National Museum of Australia Cafe. And there's actually a commemorative poster of today with the wonderful Mickey of Ulladulla on it. Please take one as you leave, as a memento of what I think has been the most fantastic day for me, and I hope for everybody here. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.